Welcome, Anatomy fans. Today on Anatomy of Movie, we dissect Kubo and the Two Strings. So look forward to that and stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, Kubo and the Two Strings, the new stop-motion movie. I'm excited. I love stop motion. I thought this was a fantastic movie, and we're going to dissect it. And yes, we will talk about the controversy. There's plenty of that, but we'll also talk about the making of, which is quite fascinating, as we listen to Regina Spektor and the theme song.
Very soothing.
Indeed.
I like it.
We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And I'm Phil Svitek. Today it's Kubo and the two co-hosts.
Yes.
Here on Anatomy of a Movie. Anyway, a couple of things. Number one, if you want to follow along with us, you can download the rundown. It's in the description. You just download that link, and there's all of our notes, as well as pictures that we'll use when we talk about the animation stuff. Secondly, we assume that you've seen the movie, so it's very spoiler-filled. If you've not seen the movie and don't mind, then listen up. Or, if you do mind, go see the movie first, then come check us out. But as always, let's start with quick thoughts with you, Marissa.
You know what? I was actually excited to see this film. I'm not the biggest fan of stop motion, but I remember seeing the trailer for this film in the summer of 2015. And I went throughout the whole year wondering when the heck this movie came out. And then I realized it's coming out now, like a full year later. So I've been waiting for this movie for a while. And I went into it, you know, very thoroughly surprised. And I thought the animation was, you know, beautiful, visually stunning and whatnot. The storyline was a little all over the place for me, but we'll get into it. But overall, I did enjoy this film.
I didn't know much about this movie going into it. In fact, I almost missed it because, to me, I didn't see a lot of promotion for it. And then people started getting excited for Kubo, and I was like, what the hell is this crap? And then it started getting on my radar, and I went to see it, and I was very pleasantly surprised. I thought it was really good. I am a huge fan of stop motion. I like all those various movies. You know, Coraline is a movie that I enjoy a lot. Number one, because it's based off of Neil Gaiman, but I think it's also just really well done. Terry Hatcher does great in that. But in terms of Kubo, I thought it was very sweet. It out of all the movies this year, it had something. It had heart, and you know, so far to me, only the animation movies are really capturing this well. Like Zootopia had a lot of great heart, and whatnot. This is another, you know, and so there's a lot of flaws that I see in this movie. However, they were all easily forgivable, just based on the message that it had. And it did something that no other movie this year for me has been able to do.
Interesting. And, like what?
Just be good, you know?
Okay.
I mean, so last week we talked about Pete's Dragon as well, and that had heart as well. And, you know, that had a couple of moments that, you know, you're like, but they were forgivable. Now that one was to me a little bit more predictable in terms of its narrative. This, yes, it's a quest. So you can kind of predict where it's going. For the most part, but it's still it's different than anything that I've overall really seen, because it's got that magic, and again, Pete Dragon had that a little bit too, but magical realism is more prevalent in this one, I would say. And I enjoyed that aspect. I like not only do I like stop motion animation, but I also like magic realism, and I like the simplicity of certain stories, and this to me had those elements, and I enjoyed it overall.
See, I didn't think the story was that simple, but I did feel like, you mentioned Pete's Dragon, you know, Disney's really good. I felt like this film, even though we clearly know it's not Disney, it had a lot of Disney elements to it, you know, like themes. Like dead parents. It started off sad, and then eventually a kid is trying to find himself on a quest and whatnot. And so those motifs like kind of carried throughout this film, which I enjoyed because I liked the main kid that we're following. I liked his two companions that were helping him along the way. So I really enjoyed the characters and following this journey. Storyline, I think, had some issues for maybe probably kids young, under 20, under 12 might have a hard time following this film, but adults can definitely enjoy it.
Well, it's rated PG for thematic elements, scary images, action, and peril. And, you know, I mean, that's also the interesting part, too, that I did enjoy, was that this was very action-based. And to do stop-motion action takes a lot.
Forever. I was like, how many years did, you know, did they take off of these animators' lives, you know? Yeah. I can't imagine.
But they pulled it off quite well. So I give them props. You know, so that's what I enjoyed. You know, so in terms of development, it's Laika Entertainment that made this. And I mentioned Coraline. They were also responsible for Coraline, Paranorman, and most recently Box Trolls.
Which we have covered here on Anatomy, yes.
We have. So you can definitely check that out. You know, and they wanted to do something a little bit different. They wanted to sort of go into, you know, Asian culture, Japanese culture specifically. And I can never say his name. Can you say his name? Hayao Miyazaki?
Yeah, Hayao Miyazaki and Akira Kurosawa. Those influences.
I love his movies, whether it's Spirited Away or all.
Great film.
You know, there's just so Ponyo. many movies that he's done over the years, and so I did enjoy that aspect of it, and I felt that it had that, mm-hmm. You know, but that's what they were ultimately trying to pay homage to.
Yeah, and those usually those films, you know, Miyazaki usually centers around one person, one child, trying to find themselves, and I definitely felt that influence in that film for Kubo.
Absolutely. And the writers, you know, these guys have kind of been in this family, Mark Hames and Chris Butler. Butler did Corpse Bride, Coraline, Box Trolls, and the Tigger movie, so he's he's well-versed in the kid side of it. Hames, however, different.
But he's done a lot of action with the Transformer movies and whatnot, so I think it was a good blend of animation and action, and we definitely had that in this film.
Absolutely. So, you know, obviously we'll spend a decent amount of time talking about the actual process, but before we get to that, let's discuss story. Why did you feel, because you and I seem to differ, that the storyline and the plot was a little bit, not convoluted, but complex.
Well, I personally had a hard time getting into which character was which. When you're watching a television show or a movie and whatnot, and we're being introduced to characters for the first time, they usually say their names. And we didn't really get that from any of these characters. We were like, oh, you're this person. And, we still didn't really learn the lady's name in the street that was always talking to Kubo every single day. I think they had a hard time introducing each character properly. We know what they did, but how were they related to Kubo? Were they friend? Were they family? I don't even recall the mother's actual name, other than the fact that she was a mother. And so every time we were introduced to a new character, I was waiting for their names, and we didn't get that. On top of trying to figure out what that character was supposed to be doing and how they added to Kubo's story. So I think the introduction of characters was hard for me to get into, let alone figure out the whole story.
Okay, interesting that you say that, because I can never really remember people's names anyway. So I'm better off without it.
See, because I'm big on remembering people's names, though.
See, I got their function. I knew the old lady, what her purpose was. She was a fan of Kubo. I didn't need to know the mother's name. I just knew she was his mom, and that was good enough. I mean, the only name that I can honestly remember is Kubo and the Moon King.
Moon King, sure.
And that's. But I don't know. I sometimes enjoyed that simplicity of it for me, because I didn't need to be bogged down by, you know, knowing a person's name. I could just focus on, okay, what is their purpose. And in some ways, you know, if you kind of, it makes it a little bit more universal, because, okay, your mom's name is different than my mom's name, but we can both, you call your mom, mom, and I call my mom. So that's, it makes it a little bit more universal in that aspect.
At least it's not Martha. But I mean, I understand that, but when we're trying to figure out who, during this Kubo's first storytelling aspect, and we realize he has magic and all that, and he's telling all the villagers, we hear that story of Hanzo, but then we immediately hear a different story following up to that of his actual father. I was like, are they the same people, or are they completely different characters with the same name? So again, therein lies my confusion. I'm like, okay, who's who in this film?
Well, a couple of things on that. Number one, I thought they played into it well, because much like the mother, you know, she had trouble remembering what was real and what wasn't. And that hence then translated to Kubo. So that feeling of, wait, what's kind of going on, I think was purposeful. Because much like him, he didn't know, okay, wait, is this story? Is this made up? Is this really my father? What's going on? I can't tell anymore. And like you... Yeah, you couldn't tell either, and that's what you're supposed to feel.
Yeah, maybe I didn't like it.
Neither did Kubo!
For a kid's film, it should be very clear-cut of who's who, who's the bad guy, who's the good guy, who's the one we should be rooting for.
I don't think there was any question of that we were rooting against the Moon King.
Hanzo. Nothing against Hanzo, obviously. But I don't know. I just wanted a clear understanding of who was who, right from the get-go. Because throughout the whole film, we're learning this person also changed into this person. I was like, oh, they're the same people too. Shoot. And then there's like double identities going on for the same person. And then that even caused more confusion.
You know what, Marissa? I don't think you heeded Kubo's warning. If you must blink, blink now.
I didn't blink. Because I was trying to listen.
It may mean death to our main hero.
Mm-hmm.
You blinked, didn't you?
I did not blink. I was trying to listen.
You blinked. Mm-mm. You blinked. Mm-mm. Shame the devil speak the truth. You blinked! No. I don't know. I mean, for those of you watching, listening, let us know. Did you guys feel that it was in any way, shape, tough to read? I don't know. I think that's part of a quest to me is figuring out things and whatnot. And, I thought we progressed in a natural way. I mean, because here's the thing. It would have been so terrible to find out, okay, here's kind of how everything is. Number one, I don't know how you would do it without just literally having lame exposition. And in this way, yeah, it's a bit of a mystery to figure things out as we go. You know, and we're on the same journey as Kubo. We're right there with him. It seems like perhaps you like a little bit more dramatic irony.
Maybe, like we just didn't get. I like dramatic irony.
Well, they didn't have it for you. What do you think of once we kind of got into it? I mean, what did you think of the quest in general? Coraline had the same sort of premise of like, okay, go out and get these sort of three things, do these three things. This was very much like, okay, it was laid out. We need the armor, we need the helmet, and we need the sword.
Oh, I liked it. I liked it. It was a clear scavenger hunt in a way, and it was very easy to put together that you need these three pieces to take out the big bad. That I understood very well. I liked it because it also just set up, like, who knows what kind of complications or obstacles they have to face, whatever piece of armor that they're getting. So I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Yeah. One of the things that I really enjoyed was the play on the names. Obviously, each item has, and at this point, I forget what they are because of, unfortunately, Hanzo. The one that comes to mind is the Sword Unfindable. Which obviously is not its name, but
Sword Unbreakable.
Yes. So I enjoyed sort of the play on words on all of those.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was definitely fun, especially them trying to just figure out the location, let alone the pieces. I think there was a nice balance of humor for every obstacle that they had to face.
Yeah. I agree with you there. The only thing that I woke up to, if it confused me or it just took me in a different direction than I expected, was at the beginning, because he's doing the story, I thought we would see those same villains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like especially like the fire breathing chicken and all that.
Right. I thought so too, because we saw like a shark and we saw X, Y, and Z, and I was like, okay, if he's trying to find these armors, we're probably going to encounter a shark. We're probably going to encounter, and not that wasn't the case. Because I also like that I thought the same thing when they were going through the story really fast at the beginning. I was like, okay, they purposely skipped over a thing, so it's for the audience to be not expecting these villains during the actual quest.
Yeah, that, and also, you know, I thought it was going to be a juxtaposition because, you know, they had the overall layer of it where, okay, you know, he's told this story multiple times, but now he's actually living the story. But living the story is different than telling it. And I thought, okay, not only is he doing the same actions, if he has to fight the same villains, then he could realize, oh, in my story, Hanzo fought the villain this way. Oh, wait, that doesn't actually work. I have to come up with something different. Obviously they chose not to go 100% that route. Although, I don't know. They could have. I don't know if it would have made it better or worse.
I don't know.
Took me down a weird path, which I didn't mind, but...
Yeah, I'm also thinking maybe the practicality of actually filming production of it. I mean, they can afford the small little minis to have miniature sculptures to do the storytelling from Kubo. But if you actually put that in bigger form and actually animate that for, like, full-length sequence, I don't know if that would have hindered their production.
They built a two-story skeleton.
Yes, they did.
I think they could have built a chicken as well if they really wanted to.
But would the chicken add legitimacy to this film? Would it make it? Would the chicken add anything other than being funny?
I don't know. It just seemed the woman put a lot of emphasis on you got to add the fire breathing chicken. So it felt like a foreshadow of things to come that just didn't quite come.
Yeah.
So, that's okay. Speaking of that, okay, so we've collected these items, and I don't want to, you know, we'll kind of skip around back into it, but, the downside to me that I felt was that the items eventually felt like they lost their meaning, their purpose, their weight, because the two strings, which he's had all along, to me, ended up being the weapon he's needed all along.
Yeah.
And it was just this journey to perhaps get him to realize that.
I thought so, too, because I think at that big end sequence, I don't even think he was wearing the suit anymore, the armor. I'm like, what was the point of that? if it helped carry the audience through the whole film, I think it was good. But, yeah, the whole realization it was something else kind of was... I don't know, anticlimactic, in a way.
Yeah, I thought that part of it could have worked a little bit better of, you know, him realizing, okay, like, while, you know, that he sort of had the power within himself all along, and the real power is his magic, I guess.
It's like, Dorothy, you had your way home with the ruby slippers, you know? The
entire time.
Exactly. It was along those lines.
Yeah. But obviously that was, you know, something like that, that was a lot more punctuated than to me this was.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought, again, I mean, the reason I bring that up because I thought one of the strongest things to me was the idea of memories and kind of people in general and how they're able to live on and how we cherish people. And I thought that was really strong. And so I felt, and in that specific moment, it was slightly underutilized.
I like that. And, you know, I like the whole family element because it allowed the story of the real strength that you need to take out whatever is actually from the love from your family and friends and whatnot, not actual physical brute strength, but the inner strength. And I think that was a good moral message to everybody, not just adults, but kids can definitely learn something from that.
Absolutely. And unlike most, I was wondering how they would actually end it. And to me, it was one of the most, it was kind of a surprising ending because you would think that they would kill off the Moon King, you know, because that's what a typical story has taught us that they would happen. But no, because it's his grandfather, you know, they just basically lobotomize him.
Yes, funny, but also made me angry. I'm like, okay, they completely stripped of his memories, and then he doesn't know who he is. And then what I was more upset at was the villagers immediately forgot the fact that he just tried to kill them all. And we're like, oh, you're good. You're fine. It's okay. You used to be the nicest person. And I guess you're back to that person. We immediately forgive you after you literally just tried to kill all of us 2 minutes earlier. They were too quick to forgive.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but in a way, that's kind of what I like about it, is that culturally, at least, what it's doing is that, okay, obviously, it's you shouldn't necessarily forgive someone if they, like, literally destroy your village, but they found the good in him, and they saw that they could change him. They saw, just like with the mother, you know, she had goodness within her all along, and so did he just didn't know it, right? And remember what Hanzo said to the mother? He said, you know, you are my quest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, four words. You are my quest. So for Kubo, the quest wasn't, you know, the three things. It was the grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the quest, and he succeeded. And that, to me, is really special.
He was able to turn the grandfather back to good. Yeah. I enjoyed that, and I liked how it was a fairly clean ending, but, like, realistically, if someone's trying to literally destroy your village...
This is not a realistic story!
I know. Someone trying to destroy your village, it was just, at the end, I'm like, okay, suspend the disbelief. Okay, he's good. He's a good guy.
All right, I'll give it to you another way, right? Kubo was the one who kind of initiated it, right? If memory serves me 100% correct. Kubo's the one who said, oh, grandfather, blah, 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 you're good. And then the old lady and the old man sort of kind of came in, and then the rest of the village, right?
Yes.
So, if nothing else, it was the village supporting Kubo and having faith in Kubo, and therefore Kubo had the strength to know that he had changed his grandfather. And that is true strength.
That's the inner strength within That's Kubo right. and the villagers.
Wouldn't you want people to back you up?
Yeah, of course.
So there you go. That's the moral of the story. And that, to me, that is poetry. That is poetic, baby.
It was a very clean ending. And a happy ending with the grandfather, so I'll give them that.
Absolutely. And even, you know, the souls of Hansel and the mother, they
yeah, and he even down got the to river. Say, he saw his parents for, again, kind of happy reunited.
Absolutely. So, I thought it worked really well. Again, could have been a little bit heightened, just a little bit. But overall, I thought it worked really well. Let's talk about the magic realism in this, because obviously, you know, it takes ideas and very powerful ideas and gives them a literal form to live in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what I kind of liked about this movie. You know, the whole idea of memories and spirits and everything like that. It gave a visual representation through obviously magic. But what did you realism?
I enjoyed it because I haven't really heard any stories of someone playing shamisen and having paper origami come to life. I thought that was visually cool, and the fact that it was like a family thing between the grandfather always after Kubo when he was a baby, and then the mother had magic, so Kubo also had magic. It was a family related thing. I enjoyed that, and it was fun to see Kubo's magic actually progress as with the journey, because the farther he went, the stronger he got, and I like that because it got to the point of unpredictability, and we didn't know what Kubo was capable of anymore, especially when it came to the end fight. I'm like, something, he's gonna pull something out of the air and that we haven't seen, and it's gonna be cool. But I enjoyed it because visually it was just stunning and cool to watch as well.
And what I liked, you know, he grew stronger, but he was still also immature at times, right? The whole, the bird going up the monkey butt.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it randomly decided to be a mosquito. And so then that was a point where he couldn't control his powers. So I enjoyed that side of it because it played with his immaturity. And then once he lost his parents, for the real time, then he sort of, even though he retained his sense of humor and his sense of forgiveness and his sense of love, I feel like he didn't necessarily lose his innocence, but he matured.
He got more serious, especially, and I felt he was actually starting to use his magic for the quest, like building a boat out of leaves, something that was actually enhanced their journey and actually helped them along the way. I like that, and the fact that he could fly, you know, also helped during trying to get the sword and whatnot. So, you know, his different things that we would learn at that moment is like, oh, he's capable of doing this too. It really helped them along the way.
And you know what's also interesting too, you know, that obviously the power of the two strings becomes ultimately powerful because, you know, the memory stuff, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but it's interesting, his magic becomes more powerful the more he understands and loves his parents. Because as he was, like, his journey, while it's a very, it's an inner journey, it's also, obviously, you know, he's always with his parents, you know. However, he doesn't know, number one, he doesn't start off knowing that they are his parents. They don't even know that they're both his parents.
Yeah.
And so when that starts to kind of come into fruition, then he also gets more powerful. Because I think, you know, it brings him happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I like think Peter it's Pan. Like, the bond, because we also see the monkey and the beetle, like, they didn't like each other. And then once they started bonding and whatnot, and then bonding with Kubo, I felt like it reflected his powers. So the stronger the relationship got, the stronger his powers got.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the two strings in terms of, you know, obviously he's got the two strings throughout, and it's play on that. But eventually, you know, as the monkey says to him early, memories are a powerful thing. And so, in the end, he replaces the two strings with two strings that are memories of his father and one of his mother. Mm-hmm. It's actually interesting because I feel like it's pulled off of an atheist belief, in the sense that if you don't believe in heaven or hell, well, then you kind of think like, oh, it's sad. Once the person dies, they're gone forever. But it's like, no, they can live on through memory, and that's interesting.
It's very true. And I did like that because it also just kind of wrapped up the whole parent storyline as well, because they tried to always be there for Kubo. And even when they physically weren't there, they were there in memories. And I thought that added to the inner strength. And then also he added his own string. So it was three strings. And I like that because also in retrospect, I was like, yeah, we should have known that because, you know, strings are usually from hair. And I liked how he combined all three to be even more powerful than his mother. When we saw her do the exact same magic, I like that because it showed just how much he growed along with the inner strength.
Yeah. By the way, I you know, in terms of, I didn't quite know why. I love the reveal when we find out why the Moon King wants Kubo's second eye. So he doesn't have to be, so, because ironically he's blind to the realities of the world by having two eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very clever.
Also very sad. Sad realization.
Yeah. Very, very sad realization. And you know, obviously the biggest thing that this movie does for you is it shows you, okay, you can either look at the world in a positive light or you can look at it negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be your life.
Yeah.
The sisters, right? I thought they were also interesting. And the way they progressed, I mean, it was almost like, okay, we had three items to get, and then we, as we're getting these three items, we have three villains, three bosses to conquer in a way, right? It's almost like a video game in some aspect. And the sisters represent boss one, boss two, and then the Moon King, the final boss, right? I thought the sisters had, you know, it was a great little dynamic because the mother came from there, and we didn't quite know what that history was. And as we learn it, I found it very interesting that, you know, obviously because of Hanso and, you know, just she felt like she was blinded by this world.
Yeah, I liked the sisters. They were creepy. And they definitely had that creep factor to it that I thought they did so well. But I found it interesting how it was really the mother-sister fight was bigger than... It seemed like the sisters were more after the mother than after Kubo. And so it was like two different fights going on. And you'd think it'd be all surrounded by Kubo, but it was nice to see that it was a generational issue that's been going on in their family.
You know, every family sometimes faces that.
Cool fight, though. That very animation, cool. The animation was awesome.
What was your favorite set piece?
I like the eyes. The eyes were really cool, especially under the water and just how they looked. Like, ooh, that's creepy, but also I can't stop looking at it.
Yeah, I thought just in general the crossing of the ocean was very interesting, starting with the boat. I thought they did a wonderful job with the boat, and then the way they did the ocean, it was all very cool. So I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I was expecting the shark because, you know, Kubo's story at the beginning. Unfortunately, we didn't get the shark. But also there was another moment when they were in the boat on the sea and they're talking about the mysterious things underwater. And I just found it interesting how Kubo knew about the eyes where the audience didn't. And I just like, did you add that? Was it part of the story? Because we were never introduced to that. And it's just so coincidental that he already knew about it. Mm-hmm. And yet we saw it. Like that seemed a little easy.
Fair enough. Although it was obviously it's a great play because he only has one eye. And
yeah.
They're all looking at him.
And now he's surrounded by eyes.
Let's talk about the cast. And I guess even before we talk about the cast specifically, let's talk about the controversy because this is a very whitewashed cast.
Yes, it
is. Number one. Number two, in a way, it's like, if you had to pick the whitest of all white people, I think these would be it.
Like, yeah.
All right. Matthew McConaughey. I mean, you don't necessarily get more white than that.
I mean, I obviously understand Hollywood and how it works, where they want to get top billed names for actors to draw in people for and get butts in the seats. I get that. And also for talent. There are so many Asian actors out there who do very well in voice work for animation and whatnot. I mean, they're like, I don't want to say dime a dozen, but they are all over the place. And I felt like this movie was a missed opportunity to have those Asian actors who are proficient in voice work to voice this film. Because they've built up followings of their own between anime and any animation films out there. And they could have easily brought their fans to this film.
That, I mean, with animation, I think it's one of those things, like, I don't necessarily need to know the voice. You know what I mean? I don't necessarily go and I'd be curious to know if you guys can comment on this. Like, when you go to an animated movie, are you really going because of the people who are voicing it?
No.
You know?
Not really.
And yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things, like, you know, to be honest, I had forgotten that Charlize Theron did the voice of the monkey. So it's not like I was going there for her. Matthew McConaughey, his voice just stands out so easily that I knew it was him. However, you know, I ask, was Matthew, like, forget, let's say this wasn't an Asian thing, or let's say, like, if you were picking the best actor to play the Beatle, regardless of, you know, again, cultural context, would he have been the best choice as an actor? I don't necessarily think that he would have.
I would say no, because he hasn't done animation films. He's more the live action, which is totally fine and Academy Award winning. But again, I think there are other actors who are just as good, if not better, than Matthew McConaughey for a voice acting role.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's just one of those things, you know, especially with this, like when we talk about box office, it clearly didn't draw that many people because Charlize Theron and Matthew McConaughey were here. But it seems like it hurt it. Now, on the flip side, God forbid there would have been Asian actors in this and it would have done equally, but they would have said, well, if we put Charlize Theron in there, it would have done way better. But it's a catch-22, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't type of thing. And you know what? So in that regard, I don't know, just take a shot. Take a shot and use somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there are other actors out there who could have easily emoted as deeply as Charlize or Matthew McConaughey with these characters. I mean, they are fun characters, and there are some real moments, but I think there are a lot of talented people out there who could have executed the same thing.
I agree. So, in that regard, let's talk about who we do have on hand, because, you know, it's one of those things, it's really tough for me, because I do want to see more diversity and things like that, at least an effort, but at the same time, when I do look at the movie, for me, you know, I didn't necessarily mind it. Like, I thought the movie worked well enough, so it's one of those things that I can't fully judge, unfortunately. But I would like to see an effort.
Yeah, well, I mean, so. Watching it was, and listening to the voices, I definitely could tell that was Charlize Theron's voice, and she's a great actress as well. So, like, I didn't have any problems with them being these characters, because it was still fun and entertaining to watch.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously she got involved, but in turn, Matthew McConaughey, right, yeah, he hadn't done animation, but he was interested in doing it. He said he'd been wanting to do it for a while, and he wanted to do something for his kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yes, this falls in that realm of, you know, definitely something your kids can watch, Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah, I mean, good for him. He just wants to be a cool dad, and Charlize was the same way with her kids, because all the films that she does are usually, like, adult content, and her kids are probably too young to watch them now, but she always wanted to do something to appeal to her younger kids as well. So, I mean, it was good that both of them were on board for this film.
Yeah. Kubo is played by Art Parkinson. He's done quite a bit despite being a young kid.
Yeah, and the funny thing is he's so Irish. You wouldn't think it. I was listening to interviews of him for research for this film, and you would never think he voiced Kubo. It's actually really funny.
Well, that makes him quite good. I mean, this guy's already been in Game of Thrones, San Andreas, Dracula Untold, Dark Touch, quite a bit.
Yeah, and I like the story of how he got involved with this movie. He sent in an audio clip audition via email and whatnot, but he was younger. I mean, Art Parkinson right now is only 15, and this movie, you know, animation takes forever. It takes a long time for the process. So this was already years ago. This was about like 3-4 years ago, and he was 11 when he sent in his audition. His voice very high pitched, still very young. And then he did a different movie in between, and his voice dropped because of, you know, maturing in age and whatnot. And then when he got hired, his voice dropped so low that the director, Travis Knight, he's like, can you do your voice higher like you originally said sent in the audition? So with his lower voice, he had to, you know, go higher. It was funny.
To go up. Yeah, that's obviously very interesting. You know, it's one of those things that is sort of beyond his control.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, obviously, I thought he did. I thought he did a really good job. Overall, really good job. Ralph Fiennes plays the Moon King. To me, most notably known as either from Grand Budapest Hotel or Lord Voldemort.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of it in that regard, you know, he plays one villain and he's a villain in here. And in some ways, a similar villain.
Really good. I mean, and I think he has a very soft, silky voice that's very menacing at the same time.
Absolutely. Rooney Mara as the sisters, I didn't recognize her, and I thought she did a very good job of just being creepy.
Same here. I didn't recognize that she was in this film. I like the fact that it was basically two of her, and they just kind of doubled her.
Mm-hmm.
But it added to the creep factor.
Indeed. And George Takei is in this as well, which... By the way, like, out of all things, like, the fact that they didn't, like, tout that a little bit more, he is one of the most recognized... Not only is he one of the most recognizable Asian actors, he has one of the most recognizable voices in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, very interesting that they didn't include that as part of the marketing.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it is unfortunate that people are calling this movie whitewashed in majority, like, from face value, you can say that. But then, I mean, George is a part of this film, and he was one of the first people casted. So it's nice to have an actual face in that culture representing this film as well.
Yeah. So let's talk about Travis Knight. First time directing, but he is the president and CEO of Leica Entertainment. So obviously knows a thing or two about this process.
He got inspiration because when he was younger, he took a trip with his father to Japan, and it just kind of stuck with him. He fell in love with the culture and the stories and whatnot, and he just always wanted to do something based on Japanese culture. And, you know, this film just kind of opened the door for that.
Mm-hmm. It did. And it opened up to a warehouse, and right outside of Portland is no soundstage here.
Yep. And they worked on a makeshift soundstage, but they're actually expanding because that's how big Leica is getting with their films and whatnot, that they're expanding more buildings just so they can do... For the most part, they only work on one film at a time, but now they're getting so big that they're working on two films, two animation films, and that takes a lot, as you can tell.
You know what's just, I'm not 100%, I don't really fully know this world, but I don't think they need more space. They need to downsize their miniatures to be miniatures.
Mini miniatures.
Because, you know, as I joked about it, the skeleton is basically two stories tall. It set the Guinness Book of World Record.
Yes, it did.
So... You know, let's go a little bit smaller if we can.
Well, and I understand. It's good that they had the space for the practicality and tried to just get it to scale. But that's how serious they are when it comes to perspective and filmmaking in general. I'm glad that they actually utilized their seemingly smaller space to achieve something so big.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of all the stop-motion animation movies that I've seen, and, you know, to me, the fun was always, they were just tiny little things, you know? When you make it that big, it seems like you're actually making a live-action movie, in some sense.
Oh, they were very serious, and that was a very serious skeleton.
Yes, I believe we have a couple of pictures of the skeleton, correct, Marissa?
Yes, we do have a picture of the skeleton. Made to scale. The cool thing about the scale, it is 16 feet tall, 400 pounds on a rotating base. And they said originally they were going to make a small skeleton, but it was so hard to move and actually control that they just pretty much built it on a rig and had remotes to it so they can. It was like an oversized puppet, they said.
Yeah.
Really cool. 9-foot arms. So it could be properly motor-driven and puppeteered. It was really neat. And it had to be, obviously, on a green screen. And the because it was so tall that the floor had to be even lower than normal, so they had to dig into the floor, and they had to raise the roof.
Let me ask this in general, in terms of the animation. Part of it was, as I watched it, it was tough to differentiate whether or not it was fully stop motion or not, because they digitally smoothed out the movements. Obviously there is some green screen work, so there's CGI there. Visually, how did you take it in? Because it's something new, and I think in time perhaps we'll get a little bit used to it, but I'm very much a fan of the old stop animation and the sort of any rigidity that offers. I didn't mind, and I thought that was part of the charm.
I didn't mind it at all because I thought it was so big and so cool to look at and also menacing at the same time that I didn't really pay attention to the animation. I got lost in the action, which I think a film did its job when you don't even think about the animation anymore. And it kind of reminded me, for some reason, Indiana Jones and whatnot. They're in a cave and they're trying to fight off these things. It was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think they took a lot of inspiration. The whole, getting the right sword out reminded me of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where it's choose the right cup.
Yeah, no, exactly. That, I think that's where my mind was correlating it with.
In terms of, okay, so the origami boat, the fact that they made this ocean practically between using like the old school, like almost like what do you call it, like cutouts of ocean and kind of doing it that way, mm-hmm. and then to do basically a rig that had that wires that moved, and on top of that is basically just a blue sheet.
Yep.
And we have a couple of pictures of that. So, and by the way, if you're listening on audio, like I said, if you download the rundown, we'll include these pictures in there. But you know, like I said again, it's just so crazy to me the fact that this is not necessarily a CGI ocean.
No, it's like water cutouts that anyone could pretty much make, and you know, you just have the whole motion action going on. But I think it was also cool because the material that we're using were disintegrating really fast, and so it would stop production and whatnot. So they actually built copper wires, and they built it in ways where it could bend and mimic the motion of waves. And on top of the wires, they would just throw a blue sheet over it, so it would have water like moving up and down.
Yeah.
Pretty neat. Practical.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I don't know if practical. But certainly worked.
That did.
The eyes themselves, you know, I thought that these would be like the smallest little thing. These legitimately you could like walk in front of, and it was the size of pretty much you.
But it's so cool. It's even bigger than like the normal human being. Visually very cool, and it's like
visually creepy.
Yeah, but it's awesome. And what I liked is how they built it. It was like metal mesh, more so. Kind of like paper mache, but like out of metal. And in the center, they had a bunch of lights that emitted electricity, so it would give that glowy look for the eyes and the irises and whatnot. And then also, because of the motion, it is a fairly rounder object, that they built this encoding system where they pretty much paired it up with a bowling ball, and you know how bowling balls can rotate like 360. They mimic the motion of a bowling ball. It's really neat.
There you go.
Smart. Who would have thunk?
Hey, listen, we built what's his name? BB-8. I think, yeah, we can
see. There's a bowling ball
right there. Just having fun.
So you can rotate it, and the cool thing with bowling balls, it has holes in it, so like you can already put your fingers in it and just move it in whatever direction you want.
I can only imagine. Someone was definitely in a bowling league and like brought their bowling ball into work. and they're like, oh, dude, do you need that? Here, that could totally work for this.
Yeah, I mean, shoot, I bowl a lot, and I would have never thought to apply that to actual production.
Well, there you go. Now you know you can. all right, let's talk about the music. Dario Marianelli, mm-hmm. did it. Academy Award nominee. Done things like Pride and Prejudice, Brothers Grimm, and V for Vendetta.
He's also worked on The Box Trolls, so he does have a connection with Laika Entertainment as well.
Yeah, and I thought overall, really good soundtrack. Most of it obviously is original, mm-hmm. With the exception of the Regina Spektor song. So I thought it fit really well.
I felt there was a lot of string instrumental, especially that kind of reflects the whole Japanese culture and their musical instruments. And I really liked it.
And the two strings.
But they use the mix of, you know, different guitars that Japanese culture usually use. I can't remember the exact name, but they use assortment of different stringed musical instruments in the music.
Yeah. And I thought it had a great motif, and it built upon that, you know, the slow, like you would always start off slow, and then it build and build and build and build, and then, you know, all the origami is flying everywhere. Just really well done.
It's neat. Yeah. And I liked how, you know, it reflected the vast musical strings in the musical notes.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Absolutely. And I thought the Regina Spektor song that we listened to, While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Sad title.
Sad title, but fitting. You understand it, mm-hmm. You know, because obviously it's the memories of two loved ones that are now lost.
Yeah, the strings are no longer there. Yep.
Exactly. So it worked out really well.
See, there's the strings. But very neat. It definitely reflects the Japanese culture and music.
Yeah. Even the music, however, is a little bit whitewashed.
It can fade. The average Regina Spector, yeah.
So anyway. Let's see. The film, in terms of promotion, like I said, I didn't see a lot of promotion based around this.
No, I feel like this movie had a last minute big push, because I've heard a lot about this film in the last month and a half, but I knew about this film for a long time. I knew about it since last year, and I'm like, when the heck is this film coming out? And then we didn't hear about it for a year until now. So I don't know if it was just because production and animation takes forever, or like the timing was just better in this year. But yeah, for you think for a film that has big names such as Matthew and Charlize, you think it would have a bigger push. But I didn't really hear it.
Yeah, which is quite a shame, you know. Especially like between it being a family movie and just, to me, a good movie in general. I think it's a shame that, you know, it's reflected a little bit in the box office. Hasn't done that well yet. Worldwide so far, you know, about 12 million domestic, 13 million worldwide. So not doing too great.
Yeah, it has a long way to go, because I believe their budget million was $60 million. Yeah, so it's got a while. Got a ways.
Here's the shame, though. Like, it's got a 96% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 91 audience score with an AA cinema score. So, like, the people that are seeing it obviously like it.
That's really high.
Across the board, it's not just, like, critics disagreeing with audience members disagreeing with critics, like, across the board.
Right. And it's not like that there's a lot of animation films out right now. I think we only have Sausage Party, which is, like, geared towards...
We still have Secret Life of Pets.
Yeah, that too.
That's a little different, and that's a little comedy.
But I don't feel like there's much competition for a kid's film as of right now, other than Pete's Dragon, which is live action.
And that's also not doing too great either right now,
no,
to be fair. Which is a shame, because that's not a bad movie either.
And I don't know if it's also because school's back in session, kids didn't go to it last weekend, or... which is a shame, because this is actually a really solid film, and kids should see it. But maybe it'll do better, or maybe it'll do better Labor Day weekend, and everyone will go out and see it.
Maybe school field trip to the movies.
Yeah, I'd be for that.
Learn about Japanese novel, Japanese culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's just so alarming. I mean, let's see, a couple other reviews. Dark, twisted, and occasionally scary, but with humor, love, and inspiration. I think that's kind of mimics your sentiment. One of the most impressive elements of Kubo and the Two Strings, besides dazzling stop-motion animation, its powerful performances, and its transporting score, is the amount of credit it gives its audience, particularly its younger viewers.
Yeah.
Well, apparently that's not you, because you don't want to give any credit. You want to be spoon-fed everything, don't you?
Maybe.
It'd
be nice to be spoon-fed everything, you know. For a kid's film, you have to
remember. No, we got to train them. Otherwise, that's what they're going to grow up thinking, is that they're going to be spoon-fed everything. And that's why we got all these...
Well, we have millennials like that. Yes. But, I mean, I can understand.
So. And interesting, no one's really said if there's going to be a sequel. I actually could see a sequel out of this.
Really?
To be honest, yeah.
Okay.
I could.
It's funny, because Travis Knight and... interviews and stuff, he said that he personally never went into this expecting another sequel in the world full of just sequels nowadays. He just wanted to do a good solid film that had a full arc.
Hence why I don't think... But I thought it was an interesting world, and you know, I think there's other adventures Kubo could take with his two strings if he wanted to. But I doubt he ever will, especially with what we're making in terms of box office right now.
No, probably not.
Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
Visually stunning. I mean, I applaud every single animator and anyone who worked on this film. They had over 600 people work on this film. So, like, it was a big, number of people. So I applaud all of them because it looked beautiful. It was a fun storyline, and I think the morals of it definitely, can apply to adults and kids.
Awesome. I agree. I see the shortcomings of this movie at times and whatnot, but again, all very forgivable to me because of just the inspiration and the heart that it has, and so it transcends all of its flaws. I recommend it to anyone. Take other people to go see it. I think the rewatchability of this is through the roof. Mm-hmm. It's a fun little movie. And by the way, as we mentioned, go see if you've seen Box Trolls. We did Anatomy of a Movie for that. Let us know your guys' thoughts and opinions on this movie. We love hearing from you guys. We love interacting with you guys. Down the pipeline, we've got coming up Don't Breathe. And then we'll start the sort of Oscar rollout of movies down the pipeline. We're getting into that season. We're about to end summer blockbusters.
Yeah.
And get into Oscar contention movies.
Into the heavy movies like Light Between Oceans and stuff. Yes. Yes.
All right. So we'll see you guys next time on another Anatomy movie. Bye.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.